Nathan Warren is Group Director for Sanctuary Group. In our conversation, we talk about the moment he knew he needed to share his disability with his employer. As a C-suite leader, he had chosen not to share his experience of neuromuscular disease. That became more difficult as his condition became more progressive. And he talks about the sense of relief and freedom that sharing gave him as well as his colleagues. Nathan is the epitome of how we can use optimism as a verb. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Nathan Warren, I am so looking forward to this interview. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to kick off our discussion about your thoughts about the reason why this subject of inner confidence matters so much to our audience, our viewers. What's your thoughts?
Well, firstly, thank you for interviewing me. It's tremendous to be here. I've lived without inner confidence. And when you understand what that can mean for your career and yourself, I now understand the importance of having confidence, being strong as a person, and making sure that you can project positively for those around you, really.
Wonderful kickoff. Well, let's start at the beginning. I want to hear about your career. Now, take us back to that 16-year-old. I mean, you're now the group director of Sanctuary Group. We're going to hear a little bit about the business and how you've climbed up the greasy pole. But let's start with that 16-year-old, that apprenticeship in Rolls-Royce.
So at 16, which now seems a very young age, I had two decisions. Do I want to go to college? Do I want to go and work full time? And economic matters in my home meant that I had to go to work, which was the best thing that could have happened. I joined Rolls-Royce, worked on nuclear submarines, a fantastic company. And I met fantastic people there who picked me up as a 16-year-old and guided me. Strong male role models, which for me were important at that time because I was from a broken home and I'd not had that in my life. They cared for me. I worked hard for them. And they set a path for me to where I am today. Without meeting those people early on in my career, it would have been very difficult to understand how I could actualize and be a leader today in 2025.
So let's move us through that. So in Rolls-Royce, what was the what next? Because you're a trained accountant.
I am, yeah. So I joined Rolls-Royce. My first job would have been delivering mail and pushing mail around a building or working in a photocopying centre. I worked there for 8 years, progressed and completed a degree in Nottingham with Rolls-Royce, working full-time and studying part-time. And that allowed me to, after seven and a half years of being at Rolls-Royce, start to apply for graduate schemes. I wanted to be an accountant because I think I saw accountancy as a safety net. From my beginnings, I actually thought that accountants drove BMWs and were relatively safe and prudent people. And I think it was the safety that I was seeking rather than the profession. I thought if you can qualify as an accountant.
So economic certainty mattered to you?
Absolutely. I think I just wanted to be safe. I was a 16-year-old who thought if you can earn £25,000 a year and you can live in a house that's worth about £100,000, your life will be set. And many people do that today, and I'm fortunate that I achieved that goal. But at the same time, these were the beginnings. I went to Birmingham, where I met my wife, qualified as an accountant with Grant Thornton, who were tremendous, worked in audit, worked in due diligence, worked in corporate finance, and worked in a lot of different areas in the firm, which really allowed me to build the base of a pyramid. And I genuinely think that by building the base of a pyramid wide, it can go high. So many people strive to only do one thing and do it well. I strive to do many things and try and build my understanding of industries, of people, of education, which for me has always been primary.
Yeah. Tell us about Sanctuary Group. So you're group director. Tell us a little bit about the scale of the business. I mean, you're a third sector housing and care provider for individuals who may find it more difficult to secure housing. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the business.
So I joined Sanctuary Group in 2005, and I thought I would come and I would probably work here for 2 or 3 years. I've been with the firm 20 years now. When I joined, our turnover was about 135 million. We are a 1.1, 1.2 turnover, billion pound turnover business now. We provide services and care for about probably 300,000 people in the UK. We're one of the country's largest care providers. We provide services for people who are disabled. We provide domestic violence services. We've got a lot of general needs housing in England and Scotland. We undertake large regenerations, and we manage estates like that I grew up on. So it's not a purpose for me, but I can see why people would think that. I now work for an organisation who house and care and provide support for people like me from the estates that I grew up on. And every day, that's my motivation. It's wonderful.
It's lovely. And of course, you know, we're very proud that you're in the Purple Space community. We have, you know, the privilege, I suppose, of observing how you're supporting your own people to manage disability and difference. So, look, you've established your credentials. Your CV is enviable. Tell us about 2010. So this is when you developed myofibrillar myopathy. Forgive me, the pronunciation is rubbish, but tell us about that, because you shared with me how dramatic that moment was. Yeah. Tell us a bit about that.
So we talk about self-actualization, and if I describe my life in maybe 2008-09, I just finished an MBA at Warwick. I was working with tremendous people. I was a qualified accountant. I'd got 2 young children. I'd been married for 5 years to Susan. And I thought that I'd got all the safety that I sought. It was as close to self-actualization as I could get. I wasn't a multimillionaire, but I didn't seek that.
You were a happy bunny.
Yeah, I was a happy bunny.
Yeah.
I started limping. And my parents separated when I was young, so I had no understanding of my father's genetic line. Myofibular myopathy is genetic, and it attaches itself at different stages in different families. It is not definitely going to happen. It might happen. So I started limping, as I say.
Through pain?
No pain. But I went to see a specialist. I was referred. I had a DNA test, because it's a DNA-based disorder. And Dr. John Weiner sat me down and said, you're a positive carrier of a certain gene. And I said, okay, I limp. What does that mean? Can I take a tablet? And he said, there's about 50 or 60 people in the UK, maybe, that are suffering, and they're all different. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, I've got no idea what's going to happen to you. It could be quick, it could be slow, but your muscles will start to deteriorate.
How did you react to that, Nathan? Because you described your necessity, your sort of default personality is someone who likes certainty and likes economic security. So how did you feel when you were told that?
I didn't believe that you could go from self-actualization, Maslow level 5, to level 1 in a moment. It shattered my world. Outwardly, in my professional life, I tried to remain confident and tried, because we're a large organization and we're doing great things, and we continue to do great things through that. Inwardly, I'm broken. Absolutely broken, but I can't talk about it. I can talk to my wife, but apart from limping a little bit, nothing's happening. And then slowly, after 2010, things started to change and my life started to change, and that was very difficult.
So you talk about this kind of 8-year period where your health declined and you were managing uncertainty, did you still not share that with colleagues and ask for help? How were you managing it at work?
In my mind, the way I tell myself this, I got a D for disability. I didn't get an A. I didn't get a B. I certainly didn't get a C. At best, I got a D. And what I mean is, I was embarrassed about what was happening to me because I was a roughy, toughy professional. I was ambitious, wrongly, for myself. And I thought that this was going to end everything for me. I thought that by 2015, my working career would be over. I would no longer be able to provide the support to others that I thrive off. And what actually happened is that slowly I lost strength in my legs. Slowly the circulation in my feet got worse. And I had to modify my life, but I didn't do it positively. I did it negatively. So I stopped using trains because I couldn't get on a train. I started to shrink my world and I started to lose confidence. So that inner confidence, despite the fact that my outer confidence was seemingly strong, my inner confidence was not. I tried to manage everything so acutely in terms of where I would be, where I would get there. It became suffocating. So I would be thinking about a trip to London, like we are today, that's been relatively painless for me today. In 2012, I would have gone into hyperdrive, thinking about how I can do that. I didn't need a blue badge because I'm not disabled. So therefore, you don't get the support. I didn't talk to my colleagues about it. We had no disability network. I had no lived experience of friends who had gone through this.
Nathan, you're not alone. It's a very common experience, I think, particularly with people with progressive diseases that don't have an end point as such. You know, that uncertainty is very real. You're now a very different creature, yeah. Dare I say it. You are confident and you live comfortably in your skin. You do a huge amount to support your own colleagues at Sanctuary Group. What changed? What were the key moments that you started to build that inner confidence? Did it come from you? Did it come from others? Was it a mixture?
I think it was definitely a mixture. And if I had a lesson for other people, it would be share. Just share. Give your data to your organisation.
Why do you say that?
Because I didn't. We had a box at Sanctuary to tick if you had a disability. Now, I couldn't tick that box. And that meant that my organisation couldn't help me. And my naivety at this, and I'm a group director, so I'm on the main executive committee at this point. I'm seen as a senior leader in the organisation, but I can't tick a box. And that meant that people couldn't help me. It meant that I didn't get the support that I clearly needed. It was awful. I was in the absolute worst place. So slowly I moved on to crutches. Then I would fall over. And then I couldn't stand up on my own. So I would find myself lying in a car park, unable to move. At that point, I don't know whether when it was lying on the floor, I just made the decision that I needed to take ownership of this and I needed to come out. I spoke to LGBTQ friends about the moments they'd had where they told people their story. And for me, that was what I did. I just started to be a bit more open.
What did it
trust.
Do for yourself? What were the positive impacts of you not masking anymore?
Oh, it was, I ticked the box. I got a blue badge. Parking in car parking spaces, which are 100 yards away from a supermarket, is incredibly painful when you can't walk, but your mind's telling you that you can't, you're not disabled. It all changed. Immediately, all the support of my organisation, which is fantastic, was wrapped around me. Suddenly, people were talking to me about the disability that they all knew about, but I was uncomfortable to talk about. It is a wonderful, wonderful feeling when that weight lifts off your shoulders. And the organisations that many of the people who use Purple Space and many of the Sanctuary employees have around them is able to do what it does, provides the support that now I'm a planes, trains and automobiles, not planes, less planes. But nothing restricts me. I have a great wheelchair. I've got colleagues, friends, family, and I can be the person that I was in 2008 again. No, this is, it's made me better.
I'm going to pack for our listeners the things that you have learned along the way. You know, how would you describe those lessons? If you were to look back at the young Nathan, the Nathan before disability, you know, what would you have whispered now in his ear to help him fast track some of these experiences to be a little bit more out and loud sooner?
Yes, that's a good question. For me, I think ambition for myself allowed me to move so far quickly in my career, and hard work and mentorship were key to that. But I think when I became disabled, I started to become ambitious, not just for myself, but for those around me. And I think I'm a far better leader now than I ever could have been had I not had that experience. I think having ambition for others and for the organisation and being selfless and not selfish is a tremendous lesson. I would hope that I could tell young Nathan, it's not a race, it's a marathon. Don't sprint it. Take your time. Be kind. Continue to say please and thank you. And all the skills that will take you through, you probably have.
Yeah. And of others, what have you learned of others? You talk often about how other people are willing to help. And it's interesting, that's a common theme through our interviews. As you know, we're interviewing the most extraordinary chief execs, yeah, C-suite leaders. And it's a common theme. But what have you learned about the reactions of others?
Yeah, well, to be honest, when I opened up, the relief on my immediate colleagues' faces when we could actually talk about this.
So they were relieved.
I think they were relieved because,
yeah,
these are people that I'd worked with for well over 10 years. They knew me inside out and they were sharing my trauma, but we weren't talking about it. As is an organisation where a lot of people stay for a long time. And I think that they were happy that they could help me. And there's a lot of learning in Sanctuary at the most senior levels and the most junior levels from my journey, which can only be good, because I hope to be a positive indication that having a wheelchair doesn't change anything. And I think my colleagues around me would vouch for the fact that they've learned too. I mean,
it's almost as if you create a permissive environment. So there can be a degree of awkwardness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every day, at least twice, somebody will say, I shouldn't ask, but what's wrong with you? So that's a question that would have broken my heart 10 years ago. And I would have mumbled something about a football injury and toddled off. Now I'm absolutely brutal and honest at every opportunity to share the reality and the positivity that comes from being a disabled person. We didn't have the network that we have now, and I certainly didn't have the network that I have now. I wish that I could send that network back to young Nathan and say, you're not on your own.
Wonderful stuff. Nathan, you shared with me a story, which I love, about your young son nudging you about perhaps using a wheelchair. What, share that story for us. And again, what did you learn from that?
So maybe 2015, 2016, my walking had got quite bad. And I was using crutches, nice crutches, very bright.
Of course.
And we went on holiday, as many families do. We were in Disney in Florida, and those parks are not small, and it takes a long time to get around them. And I'd never been in a wheelchair before because I was nervous. And he said to me at the gates on one of the first days, "Dad, why don't you use a wheelchair today?" And I looked, and he said, "I know you don't need a wheelchair." He said, "But it will just make it easier for us because we can hang bags on it and things like that. And it might make the day go quicker." And I was humbled by his compassion, a young man. And it was a moment when I thought, wake up call. Come on, Nathan. This is better for everybody if you just accept you're a disabled person and get on with your life.
Fascinating. He'll go far, your son.
I hope so.
But, you know, it's an interesting story, you know, where we talk and you will talk, Nathan, a lot of line managers who are waiting for that moment to be able to offer a workplace adjustment or accommodation, but sometimes sit back because they don't want to embarrass or introduce conversations that are hard.
Not being able to tick the box or not ticking the box. I know in organisations that there are many, many disabled people who do not talk about their disability, whether it's hidden or whether it's visible. It's harder if it's visible, and especially if you're in a wheelchair. But there are many, many organisations out there, and many of the people that work with Purple Space will know this too. People don't tick boxes. My advice to people would be, if you tick the box, your organisation will wrap around you. You will be able to perform far better, but you've got to trust the organisation, and the leaders have got to create a culture where people trust. The only reason people will not give data is because they don't trust you.
Wonderful stuff. So, Nathan, my next question, we at Purple Space are creating resources, information, collateral to help individuals to build their inner confidence and their resilience. And these films, these podcasts is part of that. And when I founded Purple Space, I did so on the prediction that these resources are as important as the resources to support great disability ERG leaders. You've looked at some of our materials, our confident guides, and we talk about the fundamentals and the hurdles. Which of those, you mentioned storytelling,
yeah,
but was that the one that had the most resonance for you, and why?
Well, there's two. There's storytelling and networking as well.
Yeah.
For me, I think that having the ability to tell your story in a safe space with people that want to listen and want to learn is fantastic. I can understand that some organisations, even today, are not in that place, and so people won't do that. And I would encourage them to find a values-led organisation that's right for you. Come and work for Sanctuary. Come and work for the other people who work with Purple Space, because this is an environment where you can thrive. Those organisations are full of people who recognise the value of diversity, and that we all make better decisions by asking all different types of people. But then I would second that by talking about the evolution of our disability network. Now, some organisations, I imagine, have huge networks. We've got just over 200 people involved in our network across the UK. And it's a place where I like to think everybody knows your name. It's cheers. You go in and it's a friendship group. It's a collection of knowledge where I would love Nathan in 2008 to go in there, or 2010, and say, something's going to happen to me and I don't know what's going to happen. And somebody would say, you need a blue badge. This is how you get a blue badge. You need a wheelchair. This is how you get an NHS voucher. This is how you get support from the government to buy a wheelchair. These are the things that might happen to you. These are the things that happened to me. And just by that sharing ideas, and I know Purple Space support this, It's so helpful. I just wish that I didn't have to learn on my own. And I now know, because of our network, we don't have to go through that. Nobody has to go through that at Sanctuary.
Such powerful words, Nathan. I want to lie down in a dark room to absorb them. Seriously, really powerful words. And I think particularly your advice to, I mean, my words, not yours, not to be overly grateful. If you have talent, you know, you can use that talent in a whole range of ways and with many organisations that are doing well in this space, like Sanctuary. Look, we have a tradition in these podcasts to ask the previous interviewee to pose a question for the next interviewer. So I have a question for you from Mike of EY.
Okay.
And he has lived experience of dyslexia. He's a partner at EY. And he asked a question around how do you encourage people to notice, I suppose, the talents that we have? What are the stories we need to tell ourselves to hang on to our brilliance, you know, the positivity, the optimism? How would you encourage individuals to do that?
I can tell you what I do.
Yeah.
And hope that helps. So I don't work from home because I had years of my world shrinking. I want my world to be as big as it can be. So I will go into the office every day. I know that I've got friends there and I know I've got colleagues there. And it's perfectly fine for somebody to come in 3 days a week and it's perfectly fine for somebody to come in 1 day a week. I want to be there every day because one day, with the kind of illness I've got, I might not be able to go in the office. I'm not going to waste any days. Now, when I'm in the office, I thrive. That is my positive place. When I'm working, when I'm out on one of our estates talking to people, I'm thriving. The journey to the office from getting out of bed, I can't stand up. To getting in a shower, I can't stand up. To getting out of shower, to getting in a car, to getting out of car, that's horrendous. It can take me 20 minutes to put a pair of shoes on. I might have to ask my son or my wife to help me because I just can't do it. That's horrible. Sometimes we have to go through these horrible things to get to where we want to be. Now, work for me is a really positive thing. We work on the estates and we create the homes for people to live in and thrive where I grew up. This is the kind of estate that I grew up on. And I think there's little Nathans out there that in some way I'm helping. I am going to put myself through that adversity every day to get to the positive place so that I can do my bit for Sanctuary, but not just to help Sanctuary, to help all the people that are like me and I was when I was 12, 14.
Mm. It's wonderful. So it's using optimism as a verb.
Optimism is a doing. Yeah. One of my colleagues says, I've not got an optimism bias, but positivity is my life force and my petrol or my electric charge nowadays. And it is. I am a positive person, but I think we can all do so much and we're only here once. We've just got to grasp it.
Mm. It's wonderful. You inspire in the best possible sense. Nathan, what would your question be to our next interviewee? We're going to be talking to Andrew Hinstridge from Virgin Money.
Okay.
What would you offer him as a question?
Okay, so my question to Andrew would be this. What about your lived experience of your own disability has helped your leadership style and has also helped your friends, colleagues and your network? And the reason that I ask that question is I know my network is better for my disability. I know that my friends are better and I know that I'm better. I wonder what his thoughts are on that.
I love it. I will carry that question carefully to Andrew. Nathan Warren, it has been a real treat to talk to you today. We could be here till midnight, but apparently we can't. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your insights and thank you for your positivity to build a better working world for people with disabilities.
Well, thank you for Purple Space.
We are on a mission to cascade insights and information about how to build inner confidence when you have lived experience of disability, ill health, or neurodivergence. So if you want to learn how to have a better and a more confident conversation with your employer or line manager, visit www.purplespace.org. And do one thing as a consequence of your own learnings, having listened to Nathan. Let's build a better, more equitable working world for everybody.